All right. Well, good afternoon. My name's Todd Bricks. I'm going to be talking a little bit about the future of Windows Phone Marketplace, both some of the steps we're taking in Windows Phone 8, where we are today, and also be going through some tips and tricks on how you, potentially as a developer or a publisher on the platform, can help make more money. Just quickly, by a show of hands, how many people are building or publishing apps today in either Windows Phone or some other marketplace or app store? Great. So I'll try to tailor some of the content, where there's opportunity to do so, on those kind of areas. So we're going to start out, first of all, with a quick overview and update in terms of where the marketplace is right now. We'll go into some of the new features we have disclosed about Windows Phone 8. There's a lot we haven't disclosed yet about Windows Phone 8, both from the platform and user experience perspective, as well as the marketplace. But I'll tell you more about what we have disclosed in a little bit more detail than what we've shared so far. And also some additional tips based on some BI and analytics work we've done on developers and their applications in the marketplace to figure out what works for the developers who are really successful and earning six figures a month, and tactics that haven't been so successful for some other developers. So the Windows Phone Marketplace, just for those of you that may not be as familiar, is basically the name for our app store. But it's not only for apps. It includes applications, games, as well as music titles. The content is displayed to a user local to their country, and includes a number of different pivots and displays adopting faithfully the Metro-style UI that's prevalent throughout the phone to showcase top applications for that given market, new apps that have just been recently published, and featured apps, which are typically editorially selected items that we think really best represent the apps and design ethic that we're looking for. And what we believe users are looking for across the board. Since we've launched back in October or November 2010, we just reached 100,000 application milestone a couple weeks ago. This is inclusive of apps that are publicly available to users, as well as apps that are privately distributed, and some beta applications as well. So we're very pleased with that progress. In 20 months, getting up to 100,000 apps from developers all over the world has been a really humbling experience. And so, on behalf of Microsoft and the number of people involved in building and making and selling the platform, I want to thank you for your contributions and other developers as well. We've been on a pretty steady growth trajectory since we started. Just over the last year, the number of developers that have registered on the marketplace has grown from about 40,000 to almost 160,000. The rate of app publication continues to grow as well. We're averaging typically over the last month about 300 new apps come into the marketplace every day, which is a healthy sign that users have more and more content and selection available. The absolute rate of growth for the overall catalog has continued to expand, especially you see a trajectory increase since the fall of 2011, when we introduced a lot of new models, particularly those from Nokia. And we've also seen downloads per user, which is perhaps one of the most interesting kind of topics, continue to grow up. And so what this is a metric of, and there's lots of people that talk about downloads per user, the way we kind of define it is you look at the total number of downloads that have occurred divided by the total number of users, not active users, but users of all time. And that's averaging about 50. It continues to go up, which means that users don't just load up on apps when they first install the phone. With Windows Phone 8, with Windows Phone 7, rather, they continue to download applications throughout the life of their usage of it. And on any given week, approximately a third of the users download more applications, new applications, and about a similar number download updates as well in addition to that. So users are very actively engaged in looking for and discovering and downloading new applications all the time. With Windows Phone 8, we're going to be focused on this part of the session really on some of the new things that we're announcing that are coming to the marketplace and are relevant to a lot of application developers. There have been other sessions here really focused on what the developer platform changes are. I'm really going to focus more on the commerce and money-making and the opportunity aspects that we're exposing in Windows Phone 8. talking about some new markets, talking about better monetization opportunities for developers, and also the next generation platform and architecture that we've built the next generation marketplace on, and how that translates for more opportunity for you. So in terms of more markets, today, marketplace is a, we started in 2010 with approximately 29 countries that we were able to serve paid content to end users with Windows Phone 7. We've steadily increased that footprint over the last year with Windows Phone 7.5 to bring the total up to 63. And in the Windows Phone 8 timeframe, we're going to be adding 180 countries, 180 plus countries around the world, which will pretty much cover every single country, region, territory, and autonomous kind of region in the world, except for those that the United States State Department doesn't allow Microsoft as a company to kind of do business with. And so that's why you see some of the countries not fully enabled. When we release Windows Phone 8, we'll be able to distribute your applications to over to customers in over 180 countries around the world. And that compares very favorably with what iTunes and the App Store distribute today at 123, and what Android does for paid apps today at 31. So we're expanding global coverage for you and the opportunity to sell your applications and games to every customer on the planet in over 180 different countries. I should mention as well that on the developer side, we're also going to be expanding developer submissions. So in Windows Phone 7 timeframe, we can accept submissions from developers who register, and therefore we're able to pay out in a roughly 38 countries around the world. Similar and consistent with the user footprint growth for Marketplace, we're going to be adding the same 180 plus countries in Windows Phone 8 for developers all over the world to be able to directly register on our App Hub, which is our application submission site, and then publish to all of these countries as well. So developers all over the world will be able to write and submit applications and make money from those applications in various ways. We're also expanding advertising footprint. So today, we're able to serve ads in and pay developers out who use the Microsoft Advertising Solution, which is a real-time bidded advertising system in about 17 markets around the world. Later this year, we'll be expanding that, a little more than doubling that to about 36 countries. So developers who have ad-funded based business models or use ads as an advertising mechanism will be able to take advantage of at least the Microsoft APS control that's available and will be made available to more countries in the Windows Phone 8 timeframe later this year. Just a few notes on the advertising solution. It's a little bit different. We certainly support and allow any kind of ad control that you want to bring and use in your application. In different markets might suggest different ad control use to best monetize impressions. The Microsoft ad control is somewhat different. It's more based on a web-based kind of model, which uses real-time bidding from advertisers that help drive up CPM. And so every impression and ad placement that you do, particularly for the larger types of markets, typically gets bidded on by multiple advertisers competing to surface their ad to the user of your application in the application itself. The control itself is a very simple control, easy to implement, and can be dual source with other ad controls as well. And it provides a self-serve sign-up process through the Pub Center, which is available through App Hub as well, and provides automated reporting and automated payouts as well. And last but not least, from a geographic expansion point of view, I should call out that we're growing the number of languages. Today, in Windows Phone 7.5, you can localize applications, and the operating system itself is localized in about 24 languages. We're doubling that roughly in Windows Phone 8 to support a number of new languages. One of the key tips and tricks I'll get to a little bit later in the presentation is the dramatic impact of localization, particularly for applications, less so for games, but for applications on user adoption and usage, particularly in countries that don't speak a lot of the languages that are commonly supported, at least today, on Windows Phone 7. So now I'll move on to better monetization. And in the spirit of getting something for a little bit of work, I want to remind everybody we're going to continue the trend that we've done for some of these Windows Phone sessions. I'm going to be giving away a brand new unlocked Lumia 900 at the end of the session, for those of you who make it, if you answer a question correctly, from based on some of the information I'll be sharing here as well. So I just wanted to bring that up in the spirit of getting something and making some money along the way, either in kind or in cash. So in terms of monetization, I want to talk about a couple topics. We'll talk about in-app purchase, enterprise distribution and licensing, mobile operator billing, as well as partner distribution options as additional ways for you to make money either with your existing apps or new apps that you might build specifically for Windows Phone 8. So in-app purchase is proven to be one of the key monetization vehicles for paid content. That gets distributed through app stores, not only our own, but many others as well. Firms like iSupply and ABI and others estimate that roughly by next year, approximately 60% of the revenue that gets generated in app stores or in marketplace-type environments for mobile devices will basically come from in-app purchase. And this has been one of the areas that we're going to be able to bring up and make available to developers for Windows Phone 8 later this year. In-app commerce has a lot of key advantages. Not only is it expected to generate a lot of revenue, it is generating a lot of revenue today for many developers. And the key reason for that is that it captures two kind of fundamental problems that are the dichotomy between free apps and paid apps typically, which is free apps get downloaded a tremendous amount by users because there's very little cost to a user, really except storage space and a little bit of time to download an app, whether they use it ultimately or not. But paid content provides an additional kind of burden because usually a typical user would have to either have an MO billing connection on our platform or a credit card on file, and so a user may not want to go through the effort of doing that. And frankly, there's a lot of consumers that simply just won't buy paid content initially. They have to get used to the experiences that they get. They want to feel confident that the purchases they're making are legitimate and they're getting goods and services they feel are valuable. So the in-app purchase model is really important because it allows a developer to do two things. First of all, it allows you to extend reach to a lot of users who may not normally, right out of the gate, go purchase or download a paid-for application, but allows you to build a free or baseline experience version of your application. And then what many developers do then is then offer paid content to the user that upgrades the experience or provides additional value in some way, and then prompting the user based on their experience with the app of whether or not they want to buy some paid kind of content, digital goods or services that either enhance or extend the application experience or the game experience when the user's actually in the middle of the game or in using the app itself. And therefore, it's a powerful mechanism to kind of catch the user when they're in a position that they're using the application and would be potentially more willing to buy or download content to either extend their game, advance their level, buy additional goods and services within the app. And then the third kind of aspect, too, which some of our reporting capabilities will enable for in-app purchase, is the ability to kind of add and modify different paid content types for different user segments. So as you learn more about your users and how they're interacting with your application, you have the opportunity to add additional content and paid content types to the application very easily throughout the life cycle of the application, kind of tuning it effectively to maximize yield with users in terms of the content and services they're interested in doing. So the way that'll work in practice is we're supporting basically two high-level types of content. Durables, which you can kind of think of as guns, and consumables, which you can think of as kind of like bullets. And so durables are basically aspects where a user in the in-app purchase would buy some additional kind of digital good or service. A good example of that would be like a new game level available, a new map location, a new map that might be available, or additional game items, which once they buy them and license them, they're there. They don't expire. They just enhance the value of the game. And so it functions equivalently as a download to own type of model, but in the context of the application itself. So you don't have to build multiple applications. You can build a single application, but continue to add levels and experiences from a durable kind of perspective. The other kind of content type that, we'll support is consumables. And consumables are potentially the most kind of attractive offering for many types of applications and games because they continually replenish and provide a recurring revenue stream. And these types of consumable goods can be things like game currency, movie rentals, access to digital magazines, additional bullets or other kind of consumable items that get used during application usage or gameplay, typically as an example. The way the in-app purchase process will work, and we'll share a lot more technical details on this as we roll it out later this year, it kind of starts with defining what the in-app item actually is. And this is really defined through our developer portal interface called the App Hub, where you define your in-app item either as a consumable or as a durable, and what kind of durable and in what kind of conditions. The application then itself, if you're modifying or building a new one, is basically you use the SDK that's provided that we'll be making available in Visual Studio 2012 later this summer to integrate the in-app purchase opportunities inside the application experience itself. So defining basically when you offer a user, is there a set menu? Does it occur during gameplay? You as the developer have to decide what's the best mechanism for surfacing these in-app purchase opportunities to your consumers of your application. Second, you can also vary these by countries and by pricing as well. So you'll be able to take an in-app experience that may cost a certain amount of money in one country but charge a different amount in other countries for the in-app goods and services itself. And you can change those as frequently as needed. Pricing changes don't go through any kind of certification process, so once you make a change, it becomes immediate. And you can define that on a per-item basis along some of the pricing tiers that we've defined for the platform. And then based on the reporting and the results and the performance that you're seeing, you can manage, monitor, and respond to kind of changes that you see in the environment, whether you want to manage your sales reports and be able to do that by item, by region, or by date to kind of see what works and to be able to iterate and evolve those. A lot of the in-app kind of commerce models for everyone who's adopted it typically involve a large measure of trial and error and product feedback and redesign in order to kind of optimize the right mix of experience and gameplay with the in-app purchase opportunity itself. So we're very excited about in-app purchase. Almost on the exact opposite end of the developer opportunity is really the enterprise opportunity that we've announced. This really provides the opportunity for you if you're in the business of a B2B software developer or licensed software typically to businesses or enterprise to kind of license apps directly to business and not have to depend on a consumer-based distribution route like the marketplace to expose users to your games or applications. And the licensing model is very straightforward. You basically build the types of applications you think an enterprise customer segment or market would like, things like from a multiplicity of kind of line of business types of applications, expense reports, sales and field force automation, remote access solutions, HR, and other types of applications. These apps then you can make available and license to an enterprise customer, typically on a per seat or a per site kind of basis. Very typical, or very common with the enterprise kind of package software licensing model that's evolved historically for the PC and other kinds of platforms as well. Once you make those available to the enterprise type environment, then they have the opportunity to distribute those then to their employees based on whatever pricing or licensing terms that you as the developer or ISV kind of define to those enterprise customers. And then it's really about monetization basically for you in terms of the different software license models that you want to use, whether that's per seat, per user, activity-based, event-based, You have a lot of flexibility to define that, and basically you and the enterprise customer define those terms. All we do is function basically as a distribution vehicle. There's no certification typically involved in those processes at all, and enterprise can feel free to distribute their application to any employee that they've contracted and are licensed to distribute the applications to. The way the deployment process will work, so once you've concluded a commercial arrangement with the enterprise and provide them the application or ZAP that they would want to distribute to their employee base, the company then can either obviously develop it in-house or they can license it and customize potentially from a third party. The company then acquires the content and applies a certificate to the managed devices. And so the way an enterprise is able to do this in kind of a secure and authenticated type of way is that they are actually acquiring a certificate that they apply and a signature that they apply to every device that's going to be basically corporate or IT managed that's in their environment. And then once you have that certificate, then you as an employee or as a user of the enterprise app can then basically install applications that you're authorized to as defined by your IT administrator on your Windows Phone 8 device. There's a number of different deployment options that we've enabled for enterprises to kind of do this. We'll be rolling out Microsoft tools, certainly, to help go do this. But there's other ways as well. There's an internal distribution so that the IT or corporate department can install these apps via sideload type of mechanism onto the device or use various third-party installer mechanisms that we'll be supporting as well. So there'll be a lot of flexible software distribution models that an enterprise department can do. And then once that app is deployed on the application, then the IT administrator will have the ability through these centralized deployment tools as well to be able to manage those applications, push updates to those applications, and even revoke those applications if they either don't want an employee to use those anymore or an employee's relationship with the company has ended. And so the IT administrator will be able to do that. One of the fun things is really how enterprises are going to be choosing to publish and advertise these types of applications to users. And so what Microsoft has done, our IT department helps prototype a lot of this stuff and rolls it out. And what our IT department, and this is a little bit of a mock-up, but it actually looks pretty similar to this, of what the Microsoft IT department functioning as a corporate admin and IT administrator for the Microsoft employees does. And so the Microsoft IT group, for example, will let you know and have a pane basically in the pano kind of style that we have that's typical and common to the phone of telling the user what apps they've already have installed on their phone, which apps are available for their use that they haven't yet downloaded. They can also do fun things like establish news headlines or other kinds of corporate information that might want to be distributed. An alert center, for example, when updates might be available or your password is about to expire, typical things that a user might expect to typically see in an email or an internal corporate portal can actually be pushed right here. And any profile-based information. So at Microsoft, our profile information-based information generally comes from Exchange. And can be surfaced there as well, but this is entirely customizable depending on the company and how that company wants to surface or push or distribute. It's not necessary to have a semi-fancy kind of hub like this, but it is a kind of a good way. And we'll be providing as Microsoft kind of templates and reference points to kind of be able to quickly adopt and customize and tailor these to particular enterprise customers and their environments. The way the Microsoft user experience works, for example, is you have this Microsoft IT app. I actually have a prototype version on my Lumia 900 right now, which I'll just quickly show. Which, as you see, the Microsoft IT green bag here, which is what we're using right now as an internal IT deployment mechanism. The user clicks on that, opens it up like they would have any other app, and of course an enterprise department can require that it be pinned to the start screen as well. The user opens that up, sees a bunch of the different pages that would typically be available for the apps, the company hub, as well as the applications that are available through the hub, and then just installs it like any other kind of application experience. And so typically a user will be somewhat familiar with the experience, and the first thing most users do is download a bunch of apps when they first get a phone. That experience will be exactly the same from the install perspective for the applications that the enterprise department decides to make available to users, but not necessarily push to a user across the board. And then you can see some of the other information or optional kind of panels that an IT administrator could build into this type of company hub, like the alerts and profile experience. The next area of monetization I want to talk about is mobile operator billing. So this has been an area we've invested a lot in over the last year, and we'll continue to invest even more in next year. Mobile operator billing is probably one of the single best mechanisms working for you as a developer of paid content, because it makes it a lot easier for a consumer user to purchase an application because they don't need to enter credit card information. For many markets that are either prepaid or postpaid, mobile operators have the ability to add charges basically to your phone bill, either debit against an existing balance that you might have on a prepaid basis or add charges on a postpaid basis to the mobile operator bill. What we have found now with over 10 kind of deployments live with mobile operators around the world is that when mobile operator billing starts, typically the revenue that a developer generates, a typical revenue generates, even for the exact same number of users, approximately doubles. Because what you're doing is helping users who haven't taken the time or had the interest of putting in a credit card on file, all of a sudden to now have the option when they hit buy to just add it right to their phone bill. And so that encourages users to not only download more paid applications, but to even pay higher prices typically for those applications as well. And users prefer this. The one-step purchase process that we have drives a lot more application revenue. And when users are given a choice between having a credit card that's already on file or using mobile operator billing, approximately 3/4 of them choose mobile operator billing to their credit card as a billing mechanism. And so we think this is a very powerful way for you as a developer to take advantage of and really be able to use this as a mechanism basically for targeting your paid apps to markets that have mobile operator billing. And so what we've done is we've posted basically a list that we'll be updating on a periodic basis of all the mobile operators in the world that we have mobile operator billing deployed and live with. Today, that's about 10. It covers a lot of countries and a lot of mobile operators in the United States, in Western Europe, and in Australia. And we'll continue to build out that mobile operator billing footprint as we expand markets and complete the connections that enable a charge to be placed on a bill. And last but not least, on monetization, we've included and supported a number of new options for device makers and mobile operators to surface your applications. The first thing we've done is expanded the number and variety of preloaded apps that can be made available on a handset or on a mobile operator network. And so typically once a new device goes through trials, a mobile operator OEM will want to load that device up with additional applications that extend the core platform capabilities. We're removing a lot of the limits that we previously had on this to make it much easier for you as a developer to get preloaded onto an MO or OEM phone. Obviously, the relation that you might have with that MO or OEM could influence that relationship. And if you don't have one, there's always the ability through App Hub to kind of tag your app as available for preload. And so what you can do as a developer is basically say, hey, if somebody wants to preload me, that typically means every user gets to see me. And I don't have to be discovered necessarily in marketplace. And so I'm just going to be available there as a preload. And so you have that option as a developer to kind of, in App Hub, to tag any of your apps as available for preload and let mobile operators from around the world or device makers, for that matter, preload your application in the device image or on the SD card itself. The other new capability that we've added in Windows Phone 8 is the ability to have your app featured in the MO or OEM store. So one of the things that we've done since the beginning of Windows Phone is have the ability for a mobile operator or a device maker to have kind of their own store within a store in the marketplace. So the whole experience provides a consistent user experience in terms of how users discover and buy and download applications. But one of the things that we've done is for enable mobile operators and OEMs to use that store within a store capability to promote apps that are either exclusive to them or apps that they think are really valuable to their user base. What we're enabling in Windows Phone 8 is the ability for an MOOM to pick any application for featuring in their store within a store environment. And since these are very prominently placed in the user experience in Windows Phone 8, as they are in Windows Phone 7, this means greater opportunities for you to be discovered across the board. And MOs or OEMs can just pick and choose different applications from the general catalog to kind of co-promote. And usually they're looking for to keep that catalog fresh, new, and also are looking to opportunities to kind of promote these kind of applications to their users and subscribers as well. And so yet provides another opportunity for you to kind of get discovered. If you don't in preload, then you can be potentially featured in a device maker or a mobile operator store as well. And this is something device makers and OEMs want quite a bit. They've constantly made this a request, and we're glad we're going to be able to fulfill it in Windows Phone 8. So next I want to talk about some of the next generation platform advances that we're making to the marketplace. Clearly on Windows Phone 8, the great news is that Windows Phone 7 apps that you've already written will run on Windows Phone 8. That's our design goal. We're testing all the applications to make sure that can happen. And so if you've already built a Windows Phone 7 application, you don't necessarily have to rewrite it or recompile it on the Windows Phone 8 tools. There's a lot of advantages to do that if you want to, but it's not required. And so you automatically inherit and are available on all the Windows Phone 8 devices once they start shipping. One of the things we've also done in Windows Phone 8, and this is more of an architectural thing as well, is we're now moving to a shared Windows core. So today, Windows 7.5 is based on the Windows CE kernel. With Windows Phone 8, it'll be based on the same Windows NT-based core that Windows as a PC operating system is based on as well. We'll also be enabling native code development. So if you have applications on Windows or on other platforms that are written in C or C++, it'll become much easier to port those applications because Windows Phone 8 will support native code development as well. And we'll also be exposing a number of new APIs. I won't be going into too much detail on those. There have been other sessions on those, and a lot of this is publicly available as well. But we're enhancing the performance across the board. And finally, we're making the platform a lot more expandable from a developer point of view. So what this means is Windows Phone 8 is going to be developing a lot of new hardware and software capabilities that only apps compiled with tools can uniquely take advantage of. So what we're doing is we're providing the best of both worlds. Not only are we providing compatibility, so if you have a Windows Phone 7 app, it'll work on Windows Phone 8. But we're also giving you the ability, with the same, preserving the same kind of ratings and review structure and SKU structure, the ability to make optimizations to a version of your existing Windows Phone 7 app to take advantage of some of the Windows Phone 8 capabilities. And I'll give some examples of some of the hardware and software filtering capabilities that we're going to be doing. Windows Phone 8, for what we've disclosed, and this is just a high-level view for those of you that haven't participated or been able to hear a different session, is going to include the Internet Explorer 10 as the PC-based browser that's going to be now on the Windows Phone and inherit and take advantage of all of the same kind of capabilities that IE10 has. We'll be supporting native development, as I noted. This is going to be particularly important for DirectX games. Developers that write games to DirectX will be able to port and move that code with very little effort because a lot of the same class libraries and reference implementations are going to be identical between the two platforms, so it'll make it a lot easier to move games that are written that way. We'll be exposing a new speech platform that developers can take advantage of and leverage the core engine and the API structure that we'll be presenting and making available in Windows Phone 8 so you can add speech very easily. We'll also be making a lot of multitasking enhancements, particularly for VoIP applications and background location-based applications that use that. I've talked about the enterprise support. We're also enabling NFC and wallet experience as well, enabling users to use their SIM as an example as an authenticated mechanism for making payments and transactions in real-world type of transaction environments. We have the new start screen with the new multi-sized tile experience that hopefully you've seen. A lot of new resolutions. We're specifically adding 720p and XVGA, but doing so in a way that will not break compatibility or make your app look bad if you built one on Windows Phone 7 because of some smart scaling capabilities that we're doing in the platform itself. We've talked about in-app purchase, but we're also going to enable app-to-app communication, which is the ability to have your app call another application and be able to take advantage of that application. And we'll be talking a little bit more about that as well. So that's kind of the Windows Phone 8, you know, in one slide. There's a lot more to it. There's a lot of sessions on it. I hope you take advantage of it. In terms of managing the life cycle of the elements, this is a kind of conceptual diagram that's kind of helped me, and hopefully it's useful here, to articulate how we're going to be enabling you to manage, say, a single SKU, a single kind of product in terms of your application, which can be inclusive of a 7.5 version of the application or an Windows Phone 8 version of the application itself. And so you can manage those two kind of applications in the same kind of SKU and experience. You could separate them and submit them and publish them as separate apps entirely, or you could manage them as a single product that just simply has two different versions, and each of those versions get surfaced to the user in the right context. And so if you have a single application, you have an existing 7.5 version, users who have 7.5 or update to 7.8, for example, will just see that version. And users that own a Windows Phone 8 device will see that same product, potentially with the same metadata and the same kind of reviews and ratings that get inherited from it, and be able to just see and be able to download the Windows Phone 8 version. And if, for example, you had a Windows Phone 8 version that might have had different in-app products, like different types of in-app purchase content, whereas a 7.5 version doesn't, you can expose those all in the same kind of app as well. So instead of having five versions of the application, you can really have, you know, one or two versions of the application depending on how much optimization work you want to do. The way this gets expressed to a user is really from a smart presentation. So Windows Phone 8 is going to be including a lot of new capabilities that developers can optionally take advantage of if they write their applications to Windows Phone 8. Additional hardware capabilities, additional screen resolutions, as I've talked to, a variety of different memory allocations and footprints, and a different capabilities that allow a developer to potentially optimize that app and take advantage of the unique Windows Phone 8 capabilities exposed. So as an example, you could have a 480 by 800 version of your application that gets exposed to a 7.5 user. On Windows Phone 8, we'll have three different resolutions or support. But depending, and you can either take advantage and optimize for each one of those resolutions as a product, as a version within your overall product, or you could just have maintain a single version, 480 by 800, and have that scale. So it's really up to you. In some cases, optimization will make a lot of sense, particularly if you're in a very competitive competitive category within the marketplace and really want to take advantage of optimizations. In other cases, for some applications, optimization for screen resolution may not make a lot of sense and there may not be an ROI for it. So you wouldn't want to do it potentially in those kind of cases. And the benefit for a developer is lower support costs, fewer versions to keep track of, fewer versions to keep updated. But also the flip side is the ability to optimize the experience for different user sets. And take advantage of the fact that our platform will handle scaling between multiple resolutions as well as different hardware attributes and types as well. One of the big things that we've done that is a hard thing to kind of turn into a feature and therefore talk a lot about, but is fundamental to everything we do in the marketplace service, is the underlying architecture of the entire service itself. That entire service is getting radically overhauled and replaced from the current system that we have. The current system that we have was adequate as we were growing, but it will not be adequate to continue at the growth that we expect in the future. Therefore, we took the opportunity in Windows Phone 8 to rebuild and overhaul almost from the ground up our entire marketplace distribution service that provides a much more scalable and robust architecture, basically built for a much higher volume of transactions and publishing load and submission load than we've experienced to date. And the benefit for a developer is that you're going to see an app hub that has much faster performance than is the case today. We're going to be able to process and ingest applications much more quickly, including updates and beta distributions. And we'll be able to publish applications a lot more quickly to all the endpoints because our refresh times will be much more frequent than they are today. And so the net result of this for a developer should be a much more nimble way of being able to submit applications, manage applications, and update applications during the life cycle of that product, and have less latency caused by our aging kind of architecture, which will be replaced. And the architecture will not only just be for anything on Windows Phone 8, it'll also be for everything else too. So Windows Phone 7, 5 devices and Windows Phone 7 devices, as well as Windows Phone 7, Windows Phone 8 devices, will all be able to take advantage of this underlying overhaul of the underlying service architecture across the board. And the other thing that we're doing is actually improving the user experience quite a bit as well. And I'm not going to go through that in too much detail today because we're going to talk more about it later this summer. But I really wanted to call out that we are overhauling the way that lists get produced, how applications get sorted. And we're doing that with a much more involved and deep usage of user telemetry information that will drive the search and make the search experience much better, make the browse experience much more relevant to the user in the country that they're in or who they are or what they've done before, and make the related content much more relevant and appropriate to the user in that context as well. And so a lot of this behind-the-scenes thing will also be based on a set of new algorithms and user data processing that will really help make sure the right user sees the right list for them. And so we're dramatically overhauling that as well. So in sum, then, for Windows Phone 8, what we're really trying to do is provide expanded opportunity. We've got a lot of feedback from developers over the last year, particularly on things we could do to help make their lives a lot not only easier but more profitable in their investments. And we think we've done gone a long way to help that in Windows Phone 8. First, we've expanded markets dramatically. We'll be in over 180 countries. So whether you're a developer today, that means more customers for you. If you're not a developer, that's been in one of our supported countries so far, now you will have the opportunity as well to distribute applications to the entire world and create a business based on that. But more markets itself, in addition to more markets itself, we've also provided a lot more monetization opportunities for developers. In-app purchase is probably the most important, but we've also expanded the footprint for our advertising solution, created an enterprise distribution and software licensing opportunity, and provided more flexibility for mobile operators and device makers to promote and preload your applications in the phone itself. And last but not least, we've built a next-generation platform, not only on the operating system, that's now based on the Windows NT kernel, but based on an entirely new service-based architecture as well. They'll be more robust, scalable, and provide a much faster experience for all the different components of the platform than we've had to date. And we'll be able to share a lot more information. I've only shared a very small amount of information today, really, on Marketplace. There's a lot more details in terms of the user experience, the developer experience, and other kind of monetization, distribution, and payment methods that we'll be sharing later this summer when we talk more about the SDK and the tooling environment for Windows Phone 8. And so now I wanted to transition a little bit to how you can make money not only today on Windows Phone 7, but the opportunities to do so on Windows Phone 8 as well. And I've kind of distilled these out to basically 10 tips. And the way we came up with these tips, full transparency, is we do have a series of blog articles and posts that we put up on the App Hub and in MSDN. And what we do is we go through and analyze all the data that exists for the marketplace across the 100,000 apps that are in the marketplace. And we know which ones make money and which ones don't, which ones are downloaded and which ones are used a lot. And so we have a lot of information that helps us distill out the types of learnings that we think are generically applicable to all developers. And surprisingly, a lot of developers either don't know about or haven't yet taken advantage of. And so I want to distill those out today. So whether you're, if you're an existing publisher or a new publisher, you'll be able to take advantage of some of these. And so the most important, the single most important thing you can do as a developer, especially if you have a paid app, which is about a third of the catalog is paid content today in the marketplace, is use the trial API. Today, only about 40% of developers use the trial API for paid content. And those that do so generate 70 times the number of downloads of those that don't use the trial API. And so a trial is basically you download the free version, and then at some point the user is either prompted or forced to kind of buy the full version product when they do that. Typically, for this population that has used the trial API, they on average get a 10% conversion rate. So a 10% conversion rate is for every 10 downloads that of the free or trial version that, that a user might download, one of those users upgrades and pays the full purchase price for that. And that ends up generating about 7 times the revenue, all things being equal, between those that offer trial content versus those that don't in their code. And the amazing thing is it's the trial API and the experience itself only is about 5 lines of code. We've written it. You can just put it in. It's a snippet. You can add it to your application very easily and take advantage of that. And calling out that you have a trial in the metadata itself is useful as well. So the trial API is one of the unique distinguishing features and can be used to generate a lot more revenue. Second thing is use a live tile. We did an analysis of the top 50 apps in every single category in the marketplace and compared those to apps that weren't as highly ranked or as rated and looked for things that could help describe this difference. And the most likely thing that caused an app to either be in the top 50 or not be in the top 50 was whether they used a live tile or not. Those that used live apps that used live tiles, on average generated were 3.7 times more likely to have a live tile than apps that weren't in the top 50. And those live tiles generate a lot more usage, a lot more satisfaction, and have higher ratings. Across the board, which then starts a virtuous cycle, because apps that are rated highly and have more positive reviews tend to be the ones that new users that are looking for something to download or buy tend to look at and use to used to inform their opinion on what products they should purchase or not from you. And so if you're not using a live tile or have a meaningful live tile kind of experience, that's something that's relatively easy to do and add from an update perspective, and you should call that out prominently in the application itself, in the discovery metadata. The second thing that correlated most highly with apps being in the top 50 versus not being in the top 50 for any given category was push notifications, which can include toast or additional information. Users are used to and like the aspect of the phone where their start screen functions as their dashboard that keeps them up to date with information, news, and snippets of information that either invite them to launch an app or revisit an application or gives them information that's useful and in a timely and relevant kind of way. And so applications that use push notifications typically were much more likely to be in the top 50 of any given category than those that weren't across the board. For ad-based monetization mechanisms for applications, it's helpful to have an ad control, and the APS ad control is a very good choice to use. But there are many others as well, depending on which markets you're attempting to serve. But the key thing that really drives up the highest level of eCPM for your impressions, so it's not just the number of impressions, it's the amount that are basically being paid for each of those impressions, which is your cost per thousand as expressed to an advertiser. And the more local relevance you can have to an application, the better. Advertisers don't want to advertise to customers all over the world. They typically want to advertise to particular customers that live in particular geographies or regions of a country. That's much more valuable because it attracts a lot more focused kind of marketing dollars and ad dollars across the board. And so if you put a location-based control and actually have useful location-based functionality with your application, this has also the benefit of being able to enable advertisers to bid on much higher quality leads, because they'll know basically where the user is generally from. Not specifically, but at a zip code or kind of an area level, which improves eCPMs across the board. I should say that developers that have done this and have really focused on their markets are earning six figures per month today on the Windows Phone marketplace. And so it's a very effective mechanism for making sure that the ad dollars are not being wasted and that you are making the most out of all the impressions and the downloads that you get. The fifth is really adopting the Metro UI and design style faithfully. There's sessions tomorrow on this, and I really encourage you to do that, both on the Metro design as well as building great live tiles. But one of the best things you can do is take advantage, and a lot of developers do this today. But to be as faithful as you can to try to, given how unique your application is and the experiences you want to deliver, to try to adopt Metro faithfully. This is very important because it's one of the key considerations we use in the marketplace team to choose which applications or games we editorialize and feature. Applications that we think are great complements to the core UI design philosophy, the Metro UI design philosophy, we tend to feature and promote a lot more than applications that look like they were, knockoff ports from iPhone. And so when apps get featured more prominently, they tend to get downloaded and discovered by a lot more people. On average, when we promote somebody in what we call our panoramic slot, which is the big background presentation that we have in the marketplace, downloads go up, typically on average go up anywhere from 2 to 3,000% from what they were doing on average the day before. Even featured icons go up 800%, and if you're on the featured list, it still goes up by a factor of 2 or 3. And so users are looking for ways of discovering the best type of applications. We provide a lot of different list views and try to guess what users are interested in, whether it's new stuff or the top stuff or free stuff. Users are looking for different things in different ways, and one of the ways we try to do it in featured is to really handpick great applications that use the Metro UI design philosophy, because we know that's what users are looking for, because that's what they rate highest, that's what they review best for applications that take advantage of the UI, because that's one of the reasons they bought the phone in the first place, is because they like the UI, they like the design, and they like being in that environment. So, number six, publish globally. Only about 20% of the applications in the catalog today are localized to more than one language. So the vast majority of developers have published applications basically in a single language. And that's great if that language happens to be one where you're targeting your distribution and that's all you care about. But a lot of developers are missing a huge opportunity to publish their apps globally. And so even if the language is not localized, certain types and genres of applications are kind of universally are kind of immune to localization. I mean, users. And so one of the big surprises that we've seen, for example, is the huge growth in China. So a number of our device maker partners have launched in China, and China is a very fast-growing market for us with a lot of users. And Chinese users download almost at twice the rate, basically, of American users. And one of the things they download disproportionately is games. So it really doesn't matter what language the game is. If it's a highly rated and a very good game, Chinese consumers and many other consumers will download it. So games are somewhat immune, basically, to localization. As long as they're relatively intuitive and simple to figure out, that don't require a lot of instructions to read or complicated paragraphs to parse. So if you publish, you should publish at least your games globally and ideally a lot of your applications as well. A lot of applications are very intuitive, and even if you don't speak the language, as long as you're kind of somewhat familiar with the character set, as a user, there's a lot of usage and additional revenue that can be gained by publishing globally. Seven, if you are going to publish globally, you should also think about localizing smartly. So localization is a tricky thing, and there's a lot of great or not so great translation services on the web that help translate content like your metadata or other types of text strings in your UI to the language that you're targeting. But in general, if you're targeting additional countries where the predominant language isn't the one that your app was written in, you should really, you know, invest a little bit of time in trying to make sure you have a very good translation, not just for the language, but the currency, the symbols that are used, and other kind of opportunities as well. Apps that are successful in one market, say an English-speaking market, could also be very well successful in many other non-English-speaking markets if they were just localized to those markets. Eight is right-size your app. This doesn't apply to most of you, but for some of you, you have very large applications. And while our certification certification policies do measure and monitor to make sure that applications aren't over, say, 200 megabytes in size. What we've discovered, particularly for low memory footprint devices like the Lumia 610 and others, which only have 256 megabytes of RAM, that an application that is generally loads in RAM at less than 90 megabytes has virtually no performance issues or hangs and performs just as well as any kind of a device with higher memory capabilities. But apps have more than that, depending on the app and how memory gets loaded and unloaded, can have some more problems. And so if you're on the edge of that, or if you can build versions that can be trimmed down or lighter weight, this is one way to make sure that users on these low memory footprint devices, which are going to be big sellers and already big sellers wherever they've been launched, because it's a cheaper smartphone for end users and attracts a different user segment to Windows Phone, and make sure those are available not just to people with higher memory Windows Phone devices, but lower memory as well. Number nine, act on feedback. The developers that we've interviewed and talked to build applications that encourage the user to write a review, that encourage the user to give them feedback, and then take action on that feedback and fix those applications. Users typically share a lot of applications with other users. It's a way of communicating. It's a way of sharing. And users will use their social graph and social network to promulgate and distribute and recommend applications they think are really good to their friends. And that has a way of building on itself and moving you up the rankings pretty quickly, which make you discoverable to an even larger group of audiences. But to act on that feedback, you also need to update frequently. So the really astonishing thing when we've done some of the analysis is, on average, if you're a top 50 app, no matter where you're from, no matter what it's about, these apps tend to be updated about every 2 to 3 months. Every 2 to 3 months, the developer takes that feedback they've garnered, makes some improvements, sometimes major, more likely minor, that address key customer feedback or issues, and then they build an update to it, and they publish that update. And they publish them on average every 2 to 3 months. The developers that are the lowest ranked in the marketplace either have never updated themselves or update themselves on an annual kind of basis, a very long period of time between updates. And frankly, there's so many developers now in the marketplace building applications that those developers that act on feedback, update, make new versions are basically going to moving ahead of developers that don't update or act on feedback very frequently. That's very logical, but it definitely is the case here, as I'm sure it is on many other platforms as well. And then the 11th tip, which I put in here, which isn't part of the top 10, because it's kind of foundational, but a lot of people on my team, we all write and publish apps as well into the marketplace. And so many of us, there's one guy on the team who has like 16 applications in the marketplace. And so we are developers as well that make money and participate in the marketplace, just like many other Microsoft employees do. And the key overall thing that's kind of foundational to everything is kind of delivering really an excellent application experience. And this is really about making sure that when you submit the application, it has no bugs, You implement fast app switching, and you really provide an engaging kind of experience across the board. And this is kind of, you know, motherhood and apple pie for any kind of development, which is why I left it kind of as the last thing, but it's also probably the most important thing in some ways, because this ultimately is what earns you good ratings, good reviews for your application and your experience. So those are the tips. So now an audience question to win a Lumia 900, and then I'll take questions. I love coming to these sessions because I always get lots of questions on marketplace and app development. So this is a three-part question, okay? And I put it at the very beginning, so we'll see who took notes and who can remember the numbers. But how many markets does Windows Phone, iPhone, and Android support for paid out distribution when Windows Phone 8 releases? You have to get all three of them right. Okay, you, front row. How many? Okay, wrong. You in the middle, blue shirt. No, wrong. You. Oh. You're correct. Congratulations. Yeah. Good memory. All right. I knew I'd be with a bunch of engineers, so we should be able to memorize numbers really quickly. Okay, now I'll be glad to take questions. Yes? Yeah, so we're trying to share much of the aggregate information. Obviously, we wouldn't take your data and share it to the world, right? What we try to do is look at aggregated data for categories and things like that and show general trends that we think most developers can benefit from. MSDN, Windows Phone Developer Blog, we have now a series of two articles. We're pushing out more and more. Most of this information has already been published there for the last couple months, so it's not too much new information, but it's there. But all this is really good information. We try to do it based on data, right? It's not just like, oh, what do I think would be a good thing to do? It's actually based on the data, and we show the data, how we got it and did that without disclosing.
And another thing is that we've heard about Smart Glass.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Apple TV. So we need to know when this is coming on Windows 8.
I can't comment on Smart Glass time frame right now. So, okay. Sorry.
One quick one. When they download from Marketplace, mm-hmm. Okay, could you add a button there to inform your friends that on Facebook, you'll see, so you can spread up that this application was downloaded and they don't want to do
That's an interesting suggestion. I mean, obviously, you as a developer can share your information with whoever you want, and a lot of developers actually do that because they're helping other developers learn from their own experience. But I think you're asking for some kind of automated way where you as a developer could opt in, yeah, share my downloads with everybody. Okay.
So this is gonna be really popular, I think. Mm-hmm. Especially if the default is yes, the default.
Right. Okay. That's a good suggestion. Other questions? Yes?
The OEM store ships out to the new bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
And can you access when you are fully branded, the real store or mobile vendor store?
Yeah, so the way it works is we enable a device maker or a mobile operator to have what we call a store in a store. So the experience is exactly the same as the rest of the marketplace. The navigation model, it's not like it's a separate store hidden off in the corner. We decided to build one experience because users get confused with lots of stores. That's been one of the big learnings over the last few years for all of us in the industry, which is like users don't like lots of stores, they like one store. But when you go to a store, there's typically stores within that store, right? There's like the bakery department within the grocery store, right? There's the cell phone section in a consumer electronics store. And so our theory was is that users are used to shopping that way. And so if you had a metaphor like that, that had a device maker and a mobile operator store there, then users could go there for special deals or unique offerings that maybe only that mobile operator OEM have, but they don't want everybody else in the world to have. And so what different mobile operators have done have built unique signature experiences, make them available in those stores, and they're discoverable there by their users. They also show up in the rest of the catalog, but we filter it out. So like here in Europe, for example, we wouldn't have, or in Holland, we wouldn't have the KPN store or any of the KPN branded apps show up on the T-Mobile network. Likewise, we wouldn't have the T-Mobile apps and network necessarily show up on the KPN device. And so it's a way for mobile operators and OEMs to provide some differentiation based on application content, but not be in their mind pollute on other people's markets, right? So KPN and T-Mobile are kind of competitors in Netherlands, and they want to use their application that they've built and paid money for to help promote their service and retain their customers. Yes. Best time or app. I can tell you that most apps, the highest download rate of apps happens on Saturday, and the lowest download rate happens on Tuesday. So depending on how closely you want to time that, now it's not huge, it's not like it's a 2x difference, but it's like a 10 to 15% kind of difference. And there's lots of theories as to why that is, but generally Saturday is a day people, you know, go shop for phones and buy phones. And the first thing you do when you get a phone is see what apps you need and load them up with apps. So whereas Tuesday, people don't go shopping for phones, I guess, that much on Tuesday. But Monday, they like to come back to work and they say, oh, I need all these new apps that came up. So you can time your publishing based on that. Other questions? Yes. To user to try?
No. If a user buys an application,
yeah.
Then he deleted it, for example.
Yep.
Then normally you can select buy, and then you can tell that you already have all
it. Yep.
You get it for free. But I have tried once when I bought it, and it hangs, and then I click on buy again, and then I get a bill to sort of the same application twice.
Yeah, you shouldn't have to buy the same application twice. Although it conceivably could happen, but you know, in general, what happens whenever you buy? I mean, and I just changed my phone out. I try different phones every week, and usually I found this great app. It's called Reinstaller, which is kind of an app that it basically provides a login iframe into your Windows Live account on the web version of the marketplace, and then your web version always shows every single app that you've ever purchased or downloaded. And then what the reinstaller does is it says, hey, reinstall these apps, boom, 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 boom. And I have purchased probably 252 apps, I think was the count. These are paid apps. And every single one of those apps, at least, I didn't get charged again for them. And some of them are like $30 apps. And so I didn't get charged for those. But so that's not, I mean, and that will just work if you did it on the web or not. There's always a possibility, yeah, someone could get double charged because of the way a network or a hiccup, and there's, you know, I'm not saying everything's perfect and there's no bugs anywhere. So, but if you ever have a problem like that, we have a customer support and we'll be glad to work on that.
€1.
Okay. Well, I got a euro here in my pocket. Yeah, I'll give you a euro. Okay. Question back. Yeah, so good question. The question was, wow, we tend to, when you launch games, you tend to go to Xbox Live first, and so it tends to promote disproportionately Xbox Live publishers. If I'm paraphrasing you slightly relative to indies. We're getting a lot of really great indie games, and when we first started, we had a lot of good Xbox Live titles, and we were just beginning to get indie games. And now the catalog is increasingly filled with great indie games, and we're actually promoting them a lot more. If you asked me that question a year ago, I would say that on average of the games that we feature, Xbox tended to be about 50%. Today, because the quality of the indie games have gone up and the number of Xbox Live titles hasn't increased nearly as much, we're generally promoting 75% indie games in all the featured slots right now, and we expect that to continue to go up. So we are changing, but our metric isn't Xbox Live or indie games. We don't really think about that. We think more on what is the best kind of game and application experience. And a lot of the Xbox Live games, I think you'll admit, are pretty good experiences, and the publishers who built those are pretty good experiences. They're not the only ones that make great apps for sure, but they do build some Xbox Live branded games. Some of them are very good as well. Yeah. We are planning to share some more revenue information around that on a generic basis. We're trying to figure out the right way to do it, because there's some developers that, Larry Lieberman, a colleague of mine, was saying yesterday, there's a group of developers who build an app called Taptitude, and it's an advertising-based game. They make about $300,000 a month. That's what they've shared. That's a lot of money. That's not typical. So they've made a lot of money. Other developers have made money. There's a lot of developers that don't make a lot of money. And that's just the reality of any kind of app store environment. And so, the thing is, what is the average that you really want to look at that's actually indicative either of the opportunity or relative to the install base, or on an absolute kind of basis? How do you really look at it? I appreciate your opinion, because actually we're struggling with this, because if I just took the total amount of money divided by 160,000 developers, what would that figure be? And is that really representative? Because a vast majority of those 160,000 have registered, but they haven't yet published an app. And so is it just published developers? And so we want to share different data, but we also don't want to have a mislead developers on what they think the opportunity is. Because some developers have come out and say, hey, I make a lot more money on Windows Phone than Android. Some people say, I haven't made much money at all on Windows Phone, but I've made a lot of money on iPhone. And so it varies tremendously based on the application quality. So it's hard to say a generic kind of opportunity. I can say today, though, that, wow, on average, users download 50 apps. On average, about 2% of those 2% of those downloads are paid. We have developers that are making six figures a month. We have developers making zero figures a month with games and or applications, and it varies across the board. Yep. He's still there. Oh, 23rd of June. See? Wow, they announced more. Okay, well, 180 is still more, but we probably had the data a week late. All right, well, good. 155 stores. Thank you. I stand corrected. Yes? Yeah, so I didn't go much into payment opportunities. We're going to be providing new payment opportunities in Windows Phone 8, but I'm not going to be talking about any of them today. Yes? Yeah. So so the question was, why can't I delete a submission right after I submitted it? It's by design, but it's not a good design, which is, and it's typical for all of us, which is when, we're about ready to publish, then we hit submit either accidentally or we think we're done, but then you have this moment's reflection a couple minutes later, like, oh my God, I forgot to do this or the other thing. And then you realize that once you've submitted it, wow, you're going to be in this certification process for several days, and sometimes it can even be a week, depending on when you did it. And therefore, and it's for a simple thing. We know that happens. We know it happens to a lot of developers. We're looking to try to fix that kind of issue. But it's also, you know, we also try to build a lot of automation and process to it. So when I talked about the next generation architecture, that's one of the areas that we're trying to do, because if it's a long wait, then that's a problem when you do something like that. If it's a very short period of time, like a couple hours, then it's not a big of an issue. But I hear you on that. It's not. I've done that myself several times, and you just cringe because you'd like to just hit a do-over button, but we don't have that on the App Hub yet. Yeah, I mean, what you can always do, and of course, if you have it on auto publish, you're not really sure when it's actually going to show up to different users, because our CDNs refresh at different rates in different countries, and so a user in Australia might get it at a different time than a user in the Netherlands or something like that. So you'll have some data, but you as a developer always have the ability to kind of unpublish, right, or hide your application even once it's out there, and then be able, when it's in that hidden state, to be able to update it in a hidden state. And so it's not ideal from that standpoint, but those are the common mitigations that developers use to kind of mitigate that. Yep.
Do you have any statistics for the best pricing? Let's say what is number one, number two?
Oh, the best pricing. Well, it's a really interesting phenomenon. It's becoming like a binomial distribution. So, you know, when App Stores all got started, 99 cents was thought to be a really good price. What we've actually seen since we launched is that the absolute number of 99 cent sales continues to go down. It drops all the time. And so basically a lot of people who have 99 cent apps have to kind of make it. What we see a lot of developers doing is if you're at 99 cents, they tend to go ad funded. Some of them start going ad funded at some point because they realize maybe they can make more money there. So we've seen a steady decline in 99 cents. At the same time, we've seen a steady increase of price points at $4.99 and above. And so people, and so this is just a natural, you know, if you go to a grocery store, right, you have things that cost a little amount of money and things that cost a lot amount of money. And so the thing is, different developers are finding different kind of strategies. I mean, generally speaking, today, the developers that make the most money are either doing ad-funded. They have a really popular title that's priced in the 99 cents to $1.99 category, and there's a fair number of those. Or they pick high price points, like I call something high, $4.99 maybe and above, and then really deliver some superior value. There was a couple months ago, I mean, the top selling grossing applications on the marketplace were Navi turn-by-turn applications. They generated a ton of money, right? Now, they only got, 100,000 plus kind of download, but if you're selling it for 30, 50, 100 euros, you can make a lot of money that way, right? And so it's really about figuring out target. And then there's, medical and health apps. People are building those. People don't seem to mind at all paying $10 for a medical or health app. So it really kind of depends. Some people won't pay for anything in certain categories, but will pay a lot of money in other categories, right, for types of goods and services. But it's hard to come out extract general lessons unless knowing exactly what you're doing. But there's a lot of really interesting dynamics at play on different category levels. Games is a really fascinating area, and we think, and a lot of games have moved to an ad-funded model and haven't been successful at all. It's really interesting. Games, even though you'd expect a lot of usage to be high on games typically, there's some big exceptions, don't generally generate that much money on ad revenue. And so it kind of depends what your model is. And it's really kind of based on usage, right? If it's really important and the publisher name and the value of the data is really unique, you can charge a lot of money for that. If the information is generically available and you just go to any website and find it, And it's just as easy to get on a website as you can through an app, that's really hard to charge money for, right? You have to do some kind of value add relative to what a website typically would do. And that's why most news and weather apps, are free. I mean, there are some that are paid, and they're really good implementations and get data from different sources, and that makes them superior products where they can charge for. But if you're just scraping Yahoo News for weather, as an example, and a lot of people do that, or Google or Microsoft, scrape it for weather data, that's not really adding a lot of value to the user. And there's a lot of news and weather apps now to pick from. So, and those are kind of good for ad-based models, conceivably, but it's really hard to charge money for those. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's right. So it varies by different network. I don't know the particulars of the situation in Holland. You know, the reality is, in most markets, ad fill rates and advertiser bid density vary tremendously, right? And so you do need a certain scale of advertisers to really monetize at a really high rate. And smaller countries that don't have as many users typically are lagged somewhat in building up the advertising density. Right.
I don't know why there's a difference between iOS app from Google or Windows Phone app from Google.
Yeah, I don't know how Google would do it, but I'm sure there's differences. I just don't know enough about their platform. Well, it depends on the market. Some markets obviously have better fill rate and better advertiser density than others. But I'm talking more generically across the spectrum right now. One more question, and then we'll wrap it up. Is it still okay to what? To download zap files from the marketplace? All apps are packaged as zap files, right, to the marketplace from our marketplace server. Yeah, we're aware of some people that are ripping off certain people's IP, and appropriate steps by governments are being taken to minimize that. We're looking at ways of potentially making that more difficult for users, but the reality is there's different people that do bad things and want to steal other people's IP. And I agree there's more that we can do. But that's where it is today.
No, I mean that can be downloaded. Anyone can download it.
Yeah.
He meant anonymous.
Thank you very much.
Yes. No, there are people that are violating people's IP. I agree. All right. Thank you, everyone. Got the diehards left.